Welcome back to our podcast, Tis But a Scratch, Fact and Fiction about the Middle Ages. I'm your host, Professor Richard Abels. In this episode, the third of a three-part series about Alfred the Great, I will be talking with Professor Ryan Lavelle. Dr. Lavelle is professor of early medieval history at the University of Winchester in the UK. He was the student of, and is now the successor to, our previous guest on the podcast, Professor Barbara York. Ryan specializes in Anglo-Saxon and early medieval military and political history. His many publications include the single best book on Alfred's Wars, appropriately entitled Alfred's Wars, Sources and Interpretations of Anglo-Saxon Warfare in the Viking Age. The volume is more than an anthology of primary and secondary sources. It is a careful and insightful overview of all aspects of warfare in Middle and Late Anglo-Saxon England. It's a must-read for those interested not only in Alfred the Great, but in medieval warfare in general. Ryan's most recent book is Places of Contested Power, Conflict and Rebellion in England and France, 830 to 1150. Ryan also has the distinction of being the historical consultant on the popular BBC and Netflix series The Last Kingdom, based on the Saxon Chronicle novels of Bernard Cornwell that feature Alfred the Great, his son Edward the Elder, and his daughter Athelflaed, Lady of the Mercians. I'm hoping that Ryan will share with us what role a historical consultant plays in shaping the world we see on the screen. Welcome, Ryan. I'm so pleased that you could join us. This episode is a sort of companion piece to an episode we did 10 months ago. 10 months ago? God, time really does fly by. Anyway, 10 months ago with Dr. Levi Roach that asked whether King Athelred really was unready.
In all senses of that word. And as somebody who is a fellow biographer of King Athelred, that probably is a question I should have asked you back then too.
But yeah, well, it's an interesting question, but I'm very, very pleased to be here, and thank you very much for the invitation. I've linked this meeting today with the final part of a class that I teach about Alfred the Great, which is one that I've inherited actually from Barbara York what we call in our university a depth study, a special study where basically final year students really get to grips with the source material associated with the king's reign and start to kind of engage with these sorts of questions about reputation and things like that. So we've just finished a session where we've been looking at the cult of King Alfred and the ways in which that sort of idea of Alfred as the great really comes up. So I had the students coming up with ideas about sort of making up stories associated with the local histories that emerge in the antiquarian period of the 18th and 19th centuries, where scholars would come to places and listen to local residents. And it's something that Barbara has written on about the way in which credulous scholars kind of pick up on stories and accept them as hallowed historical tradition. And that's the sort of period where that sort of beginning of the, well, it's not the beginning, but it's sort of building in from the ideas of the construction of Alfred as the great in the early modern period really comes in. And so we've had fun with reputations today. So you're here live with a select group of students who stayed on through to the very end of the session. Excited to see somebody of such important standing within what they're studying. So Richard has hopefully mentioned his own work on Alfred, and we've used your book at many points along the way.
Apparently there's going to be a second edition, because I got an email yesterday from Rutledge asking whether I actually intend to do a second edition. and the answer is, yeah, I guess so. So there will be a second edition, and there are things to update about this. You're actually.
I've been saying there's a new edition coming out at some point, but I don't think we've been holding our breath this particular year. But we are looking forward to seeing it at this side of the Atlantic.
So far, I've written an appendix in which I explain why I believe that Alfred actually did translate Boethius's Consolation of Philosophy and Augustine's Soliloquies.
Fantastic.
So that's added to why I believe that Asser actually is authentic. So we could start with that. But you're going to get to referee. You're going to get to referee between me and Barbara.
All right.
If I were asked whether Alfred deserved the title of the Great, which is a very late title, it's an early modern rather than medieval title, certainly not Anglo-Saxon.
He does
because of his accomplishments. Barber is less certain. So this is Barber's take, and I'm going to compress it very much.
Right. Okay. Well, this might be edit.
Barber thinks that Alfred probably was no more impressive than some of his successors, and maybe even predecessors like Egbert and his father Athelwulf. The difference is that Alfred controlled the story, that because of Asser and because of the various sources from Alfred's reign, which are all from his court, Alfred was able to present himself in a certain way, which was particularly of interest to early modern Reformation English historians, and then was picked up by the Victorians, and it established him as the first great Englishman and the founder of England and the founder of the English Empire, etc.
Yeah, and it gets played up in the sort of early modern retelling, doesn't it, in a big way. Yeah.
And so for Barbara, she admits that Alfred did some really spectacular things, but she also points out that his reputation after his death was not that of the great savior king. That if anything, the reputation became that of the wise king, Alfred the Wise, not Alfred the Great. And that it really was eclipsed by maybe Athelstan and maybe even his son Edward. So, and that seems to me to be an arguable case. You know, it always struck me that Athelred II, the Unready, when he was naming his sons, went ahead and he did this naming routine, basically all of his predecessors. I think he begins, however, with his brother Edward, or maybe Edward the Elder. So, and it's not until he exhausts everybody and gets up to himself that he doubles back, and then we'll get Alfred. So it's not as if Alfred is the great king, but he does become that. And I think that when we look at what he actually did, he may not be the founder of England. I would say he's the grandfather of England. He may not be the founder of the Royal Navy. He may not be the founder of the English language. And he certainly isn't the founder of the British Empire. But I think that Alfred's accomplishments are really impressive and, in an insular way, are on the level of Charlemagne.
So minor league Charlemagne, I believe the phrase is from from a certain professor's work. So whereas that sort of question of how other early medieval rulers are represented, and figures like Edgar and Athelstan being the sort of grand one in terms of military accomplishments. So it's a great argument, and but I think it, in many ways, controlling the source material is tremendously important there, and I think it should be recognised that that is an achievement. The kind of the ways in which there are what we could call an Alfredian body of texts, whether it is Alfred or not, being the sort of the debate, being one of the debates associated with the authorship of the text, but that sort of idea of a body of texts associated with the court in some ways. The court isn't necessarily a sort of single group of people in one room at all times, but there being that idea that there is this kind of controlling of the text and the controlling of the messages. The Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, for example, I find that quite an impressive sort of set of circumstances to be able to control that message. So I don't think we need to worry too much about what the to worry too much about what the reality was behind that. It's the presentation that is the sort of significant thing for thinking about Alfred's reputation. But yeah, it's fascinating that it's a couple of charters that mention Alfred, a couple of later 10th century charters, I think it is, that refer to him as the wise. But it's, according to Simon Keynes, it's Matthew Paris who calls Alfred the Great, Alfredus Magnus, in the 13th century.
Yeah, the first time. Doesn't catch on, but it will catch on. And he really, by 1901, when they have the millenary celebration, there's no question that Alfred is not only the great, but he's the most perfect man in all of history. And for me, the greatness of Alfred really comes down to his success. Mercia fell, East Anglia fell, Northumbria fell, Wessex didn't. And it's not simply because he won one battle at Edington. It's because after Edington, I really do think that he established a system of defense, which meant that he was thinking strategically, not simply tactically. Yeah. I know the argument for the Mercian boroughs, that there was in the 8th century fortified Mercian towns like Tamworth. But I don't see any evidence whatsoever for a system of fortifications. And in Wessex, the Burgle Hidage, which I really do think originates in the later part of Alfred's reign, the Burgle Hidage, I think, is a document which is a strategic document on how to defend a kingdom by having hardened, fortified towns.
Yeah, it's about knowing what the resources are for the kingdom. And I think the sort of tenor of the Alfredian text is about knowing the right resources, about to rule, the ruler must have his resources. So that's, I think, a part of it, thinking about the mathematics of it in many ways.
So would you say that given Alfred's accomplishments, not only militarily, but his accomplishments in terms of literature, in terms of education, in terms of promotion of a theocratic kingship, an ideology, that this was unusual and impressive for the period and for the history of Anglo-Saxon England?
Yes, yeah, I think it is unusual to have those accomplishments, those people surrounding the court, the kind of Carolingian model, essentially, which is translated into late 9th century Wessex very effectively. And I think there's a kind of an idea of theocratic kingship which goes up a level, goes up two levels in many ways in Wessex in the late 9th century. And sure, I mean, other previous rulers they do run with, you know, they are influenced by Charlemagne. So Offa is influenced by Charlemagne, for example. You know, think to the correspondence between Offa and Charlemagne, that brief glimpse of correspondence from the 8th century, to think what may have been lost from that. But I think, nonetheless, the kind of survival of that body of evidence associated with Alfred's rule speaks to the way in which there is this kind of overall vision that's going on. And I think that's an important part of thinking about the greatness of Alfred. Okay, I mean, there may be self-aggrandizement in many ways, but I think when Matthew Paris picks up that idea in the 13th century, he's picking up the kind of seeds of what were being planted in the late 9th century there. And Alfred's only working with Wessex, after all. He's only working with a comparatively sort of small territory across the south of England. Admittedly, Wessex had grown quite significantly as a result of Alfred's grandfather's achievements.
Yes.
But he's making use of the resources that are available to him. And importantly as well, I think that sort of significant thing is that reorganization, that taking the opportunity of the peace in 878, 879 to just kind of recalibrate things. It's a big element of the kingship of the late 9th century under Alfred.
I don't see him as creating the shires, but I do see him as creating a blueprint that could be used for shiring, and was used for shiring by, I think, his son and his grandsons.
Yes, yeah, those things are there in the 10th century. Yes, I think, well, William of Malmesbury, I think, has a lot to answer for from the 12th century, where he's talking about people being organized according to the hundreds under Alfred and this being a sort of innovation. And I remember when I put together the Alfred's Wars book, and you speak very kindly of it there, by the way, Richard, and thank you for that. Because in many ways it started life as a sort of collection of sources, but I started to provide a lot of commentaries in between those sources, and that's where that's where much of the impact of that book was. But when I was doing that, I encountered the William of Malmesbury reference. Oh, I'll put this in, and then kind of sort of pulled back from the idea of associating it with Alfred very, very quickly. But this is linking in with some of the governmental organization of the 10th century. But that wouldn't have been possible were it not for some of the organizations that go on in the later 9th century.
That's why I think of him as the grandfather rather than the father. And the creation of England is a slow process and probably not completed really until Athelred.
Yeah. Yeah. Indeed. I mean, as I tell the students, it's not inevitable either that England is going to exist at some sort of set point at the end of the 10th century. It's, you know, the kind of forms of government and the forms of geography don't necessarily lend themselves to a single kingdom that stretches from the coasts of the Channel to some undetermined point north of the River Humber. It's a process of negotiation that goes on at many points during the 10th and indeed the 11th century.
Well, I think that's one of the differences between the Carolingian Empire and what becomes England. Is the Carolingian Empire really continues to be what the Germans call a Personen Verbandstaat, a political society that is based upon individuals and individual loyalty. And England has that. There's no doubt about that, that the king becomes the royal lord, the royal liege lord of all free men. But it's also important that you end up having a system of institutions of governance that end up in the king. And those system of governance is what can create a unified state, a state that can survive under pressure, which is which England does. Gets conquered, but it doesn't cease to exist.
Yes. Tim Reuter referred to the idea of stepping into the controls of a car.
Yes, we just simply taking over because it's too good not to continue it. Okay, so let me ask you now. You are the historical advisor for a very successful television drama series,
The Last Kingdom. This television series, which was developed for the BBC, but is now produced by Netflix, is based on the Saxon Chronicle novels of Bernard Cornwell. The first three seasons are set during the reign of King Alfred. For those who have not watched the series or read the novels, Cornwell's protagonist is Uhtred of Bebbanburg, that is Bamborough Castle. Cornwell uses Old English place names for very similitude. Uhtred is a Saxon noble, the son of the Lord of Bebbanburg, who is abducted by a Viking warlord after his father is slain in battle and is brought up as a pagan Dane. His goal throughout the series is to reclaim his ancestral home, Bebbanburg, from his treacherous uncle. Uhtred ends up in King Alfred's court, where despite Uhtred's paganism and Alfred's piety, Uhtred becomes a key military advisor and commander. The relationship between Uhtred and Alfred is one of mutual respect, but wrought with tensions because of Uhtred's resistance to Christianity, Alfred's suspicions about Uhtred's loyalty because of his childhood friendships with Vikings, and Uhtred's pursuit of his personal agenda. Ryan, before I ask you about your role as historical advisor, it's only fair that I give you my overall reaction to the show and Cornwell's novels about King Alfred.
I loved the first book of Bernard Cornwell's series. I thought that the first book was really, really good. And I thought he captured a sense of what Viking culture really was like in the late 9th century. I became less enamored as it went on because Uhtred kept on becoming the key character at every historical moment. I mean,
yeah.
And although at first I liked his portrayal of Alfred, which I thought was a nuanced and reasonable portrayal, again, the dependence upon Uhtred started to really get to me.
I think the screenplay writers were really aware of this also, and they gave an explanation of why Uhtred doesn't appear in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle.
It will not be written that Alfred did stand on Uhtred's shoulders.
So what I'd like is a couple of things. One is, what do you think about the portrayal of Alfred in the Cornwell novels and in the series?
I loved it, but you know, you would expect me to say that. That's one of the things with historians. You've got to engage with the bias of your sources and, you know, being involved with the series. I'm obviously going to say I loved it, but I really did. I really enjoyed working with the team on it, and really enjoyed reading the portrayals of Alfred in scripts and helping them with little details when appropriate. The thing I'm just kind of amused by your reference to Uhtred being there, and you know, being there at all these moments in history. I'm just wondering about this sort of idea of the Forrest Gump of the early Middle Ages and all these sort of major historical moments. But it kind of reminds me of a question I was asked about it as a historian. Does it bother me that Uhtred was given credit for all these things that Alfred was given credit for? And, you know, my answer was, of course, it's a historical drama. It's a historical novel and historical drama. So you've got to, if it's not about Alfred specifically, you've got to place somebody else in there who's close to the action to be able to engage with those historical moments. So that was the thing with him, and I thought the TV series really played with the link between Alfred. I think there's more of Alfred in the TV series than there is in Bernard's books.
Yes,
because it partly comes from the fact that David Dawson is so blooming good as portraying this guy, and of course Eliza Butterworth as Alfred's wife, Elspeth, who was given this sort of much longer life than a historical counterparts as well. You know, this comes from the fact that these characters are really loved by the audience. So, you know, there's an element of the ways in which these things have a have a real impact upon their audience that comes into this. And they sort of carried across that thoughtfulness, that pensiveness of Alfred really nicely in the TV series. I don't think Bernard Cornwell really likes Alfred. In fact, he's on the record saying he doesn't like him. And in a way, I think the producers of the TV series had their work cut out to kind of make Alfred into a more likable character than Bernard had portrayed him.
I agree with you. The actor who portrays Alfred, David Dawson, does a really nice job with a difficult role. His Alfred is a complicated and flawed character. He can easily come over as an ingrate toward Uhtred, whom he owes so much in the series. Alfred, the pious Christian king, can never overcome his distaste and disapproval of Uhtred's heathenism. His dislike for Uhtred is clear during their first meeting. But the show's Alfred, and I think the historical Alfred, is a pragmatist. He recognizes that he needs Uhtred's military experience and his knowledge of the enemy. Alfred does reward Uhtred, but he does so almost begrudgingly and is unwilling to forgive him for what he perceives to be divided loyalties. The deeply pious Alfred is also a self-hating chronic adulterer. One of the things that makes Cornwell a good historical novelist is that he does his research. Cornwell's source for this is Asser. In Asser's biography, Alfred, who had suffered from hemorrhoids since childhood, prays for a less serious illness that would not be physically visible, but would temper the sexual desires from which he cannot abstain. God's answer is periodic bouts of intense intestinal pain, which some historians, myself included, believe may have been Crohn's disease. You're right, though, that Cornwell's priggish Alfred is less likable than how he's portrayed in the series.
But nonetheless, Bernard Cornwell got the notion of Alfred as a thinker across.
That's true for the television series as well. One of the scenes that is promoted in online trailers is Alfred's explanation to Uhtred of his vision of a United Kingdom of England.
One day, it is my hope that all kingdoms will become one, united under one God.
One king?
If all men can agree, yes. All that remains of England is Wessex. The birth of an England, the idea of a single kingdom called England, has to begin here.
Frankly, I'm a bit skeptical that Alfred had any grander vision than an extended hegemony like that enjoyed by his grandfather Egbert, and was content with preserving his rule over Wessex and extending it to Western Mercia. I suspect that this scene was included to remind viewers who Alfred was and why he is historically significant, whether or not he's likable.
And that sort of idea of whether he would be likable, whether Alfred would be likable, because there's a thing about from the audience perspective, I think as TV audiences were sophisticated enough in the 21st century, thank goodness, to be able to kind of like a character without necessarily liking the character, you know, without wanting to be friends with them per se. And that's, I think, where it plays.
I've argued this in a previous episode. I've argued that one of the difficulties of making any movie about the Middle Ages or TV show about the Middle Ages is that to be successful, to be popular, an audience has to be able to like and identify with the protagonist. Hmm. If the protagonist is so alien that the audience just doesn't understand why the protagonist is doing what he or she is doing, there's a feeling of alienation. It's like the incredible movie Percival Le Galois, which is so medieval that nobody watched it. I mean, it almost cost Eric Rohmer his career. But I think you may be right about audiences becoming more sophisticated, because The Northman is an example of a movie in which the protagonist really is alien, and yet the movie is successful. So maybe it's at that point. And I agree with you with the portrayal of Alfred. It's nuanced. He's an intellectual. He's thoughtful. And he's able to understand the value of the instruments that are available to him.
Yeah, the representation of the astle given as a kind of token of his kingship. You know, take this so that you know, so that people will know that it's me, those sorts of things. But the bit that just blew me away, and you know, I felt so privileged to be able to see the early edits of this before anyone else. or before, you know, before many other people anyway, was the bit with the chronicle and the representation where Alfred is close to death and Uhtred comes into, I mean, it still fills me up actually as I'm thinking about the way in which history can be controlled and nuanced, and the way in which elements of the representation of history then go off and get packaged into later periods, the way in which we receive that. And that sort of idea of Uhtred looking at this and going, where am I in this? So that's the point. It's not about you, it's about me. Yes. that was fantastic. It kind of really spoke to what the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle was about. And some people have commented about the representation of the Chronicle being a Latin document on the page on the screen, and that's not the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. The Anglo-Saxon Chronicle is in Old English, but the brief for me was to provide them with text which referred to Alfred's life, and I thought, you know, immediately as a sort of historian who works on the 9th century, I thought, well, Asser's life of Alfred hasn't really had much of a run in, you know, as a text in it, and I thought it was its opportunity to influence that representation of the Chronicle. So that's there, and of course there's illustrations. No illustrations in 9th century manuscripts to speak of, really. in West anyway. I have to add that the sort of workaday notion of the manuscripts is bigged up by putting an astle in, packaging an astle with it to make it into a fantastic deluxe manuscript. But so there wasn't anything to kind of work with for inspiration there. So those wonderful images of, you know, they're obviously a century, more than a century later, that illustrate it, kind of feed into that that representation. But it sort of gives life to that idea of the Chronicle as something associated with Alfred's reign. And again, it sort of speaks to the way in which audiences, you know, television and being a visual medium, it needed those illustrations in order to sort of carry it through for those who aren't necessarily reading the Latin the manuscript.
You know, the first time I really appreciated that the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, as it survives, the A manuscript, the Parker manuscript, how much of it is Alfredian, really Alfredian, because I know all of the debates over, is when I took a look at the Latin Chronicle of Athelwerd, and how different it is when with its treatment of Edward as being the hero of the second round of Viking Wars, that Alfred gets eclipsed, and that indicated a separate chronicle transmission. And it struck me, this is mainly because I taught at the Naval Academy, so I've been with military people for so long, is that every admiral who becomes superintendent immediately has to make his mark, which meant that his predecessor always had to have left something undone. And it's a mark which you have to make before your term is over. And you can't leave it undone, because if you do, it's going to be credited to your successor. That strikes me as these kings are very much concerned with their reputation, especially Alfred, I think, is concerned with reputation.
So do you think that could play into thinking about the naval victory not yeah, victory, sort of victory, in 896 with the building of their ships, that, yes, or the representation of the building of ships. Let's do something here and sort of leave a legacy there.
I think
it could be pointed out it's not so successful.
Not terribly successful, but it is so Alfred.
Mm.
The idea that he's going to come up with a new design, and that he's going to supervise it, even if he has his Frisian experts, shipbuilders with it. I think the thing that comes through to me with Alfred is that he is a little bit of a control freak.
Yeah, yeah.
He really Absolutely. Has his hand in all of this stuff. One of the things that really did impress me about the TV show is that it showed Alfred to be both a truly pious Christian, devoutly Christian, and yet flexible, which struck me as being true to the Anglo-Saxon Chronicles portrayal of him. And according to what I read of the sources, that he truly saw himself as being chosen by God.
Yeah.
And at the same time was willing to be tolerant of heathens who could be of use to him.
Yeah. And I think that is one of the things I recall that being part of your discussion of Alfred as a peacemaker. It's a very influential work that I read back when I was a graduate student, actually, your piece in Haskins.
I'm really old. That's what you tried to say. I'm very old. Okay.
Oh, no. I was highlighting its significance historiographically, Professor Abel, so for that. And I thought that they portrayed that sort of aspect of the long game, the sort of sense that there's many different levels of plots that are going on. And, you know, for me as a viewer and for me as a historian trying to sort of follow what the ideas were in the scripts, it was great fun to sort of think, hang on, where is Alfred going with this? And, you know, I had the luxury of being able to sort of jump through, but I didn't. I tried to read it page by page and be blown away by some of the sort of ways in which the sort of Machiavellian, we've got to use that word, haven't we? Machiavellian
yes.
plot twists were going there. And I think that is a thing with it. It's that sort of sense of the greater, you know, the sort of long game as well as the immediate victories and sometimes those... sometimes the long game is more important than the immediate victories and not worrying so much about who might get hurt in the process as
yeah.
well, I think is the other thing for it. And and how people around him might be of use to him. So Uhtred in that sense is, you know, is a fictional character. There's a little bit of history in that figure, but it has nothing to do with Alfred specifically, but people around Alfred using people around him, I think, is evidently part and parcel of the court culture in the early Middle Ages. I think Alfred's success is as a historical figure is predicated on those figures of talent who were around him and making best use of those people.
It's a period in history in which success depends upon being able to inspire loyalty and to be able to inspire loyalty by rewarding.
Yeah.
And Alfred was good at both.
Yeah.
There are exceptions. Ealdmund Wulfhere, apparently, was not that inspired. But all in all, the fact that Alfred's nephews stayed in his court itself is an interesting thing.
Yeah. Although I think part of me thinks there's something going on with him setting them up to fail after his death, essentially.
Oh, I think
setting them up with no opportunity to, you know, pushing them against the wall, essentially.
If
both nephews, I mean, Æthelhelm may well be dead by 899, But Ethelwald's action seems to be sort of born partly out of desperation.
It is. And he could see that Alfred was setting up Edward. You know, it's even possible that he may have elevated him to be king of Kent. There's a possibility of that.
Oh, yes. Yeah, a distinct possibility. I think, you know, thinking about his reference, his appearance on the charter witness list.
So Athelwold could see himself being pushed aside.
The Alfredian sources are unsympathetic to Athelwold and his claim to the throne, but they are not nearly as brutal as Cornwall and the screenplay writers. In the books in the series, Athelwold comes over as a worthless, drunken lout. In the first episode of season one, he's introduced as in a drunken stupor in a garden. His father, King Athelred, calls him an embarrassment and says he's unfit to be his heir. At this point, I could imagine Alfred saying, "Hear, hear." However, given that Athelwold was a child at the time of his father's death, this assessment strikes me as a tad harsh, but it accomplishes two things for the series. First, it justifies Alfred's succession to the throne. Second, it sets up Athelwold to be one of the main antagonists to Uhtred. The series simplifies history by eliminating Athelwold's brother Athelhelm, about whom we know virtually nothing anyway.
One of the things that always interested me, even though I grant that Alfred himself is not the king's name to conjure with afterwards, it's that his lineage, not Egbert's lineage, but it's Alfred's lineage, which becomes the lineage that makes you king worthy.
Yes, absolutely. So, yeah, we don't have Ethelwerd, the chronicler, trying to project himself as a king.
There's no indication that Athelwerd was considered to be even throne worthy in 978 when a child, Athelred II, Athelred the Unready, was elected king. And this despite Athelwerd, as he tells us, being a descendant of Alfred's older brother, King Athelred.
Which is interesting. You don't have any of the collateral lines. You have none of the collateral lines striving for kingship. And that's a truly successful king who manages to establish his lineage as being the lineage of the throne worthy.
Yeah. So I think that's evidently a good note to be finishing on.
Really, I think so too. Anyway, thank you very much for joining us on this.
Okay, and thank you very much for coming into coming in virtually into my class as well.
Anytime,
so students enjoyed seeing you.
Anytime. I'm a retiree, and besides grandchildren and tennis and podcasting, I'm at your service.
And finishing the second edition of the biography, of course.
Yeah, and right. Of course, you and my wife both nag me. That's okay. Okay. So bye for now.
Bye for now. Bye-bye. Thank you very much, Richard. Bye-bye.
If you were enjoying 'Tis But a Scratch, Fact and Fiction About the Middle Ages, please let your friends know about it. Good reviews and good ratings really help spread the word. Until next time, bye for now.